conquered world may face a revolution that creations admit. And Yadus, science and life is a creation because, of course, it's something which is unexplainable. Once you mention creation, so you know, what you're saying is that there is, that at the end of the scientific investigation. Because what happened before creation is not really physics anymore, it's metaphysics. And science had always assumed the steady state of the universe. Because it was assumed that if you base your science on that, then there's nothing more to explain. If you say that simply everything always existed, then there's nothing more to explain. When you say there's a creation, so the question is what's beyond it, or prior to creation. Prior, not meaning time. But an interesting article that was written by Arno Penzias, and he's a physicist. He's the one who discovered the background radiation, which has a big impact on science. I gave a 29 years ago. And he's a Nobel Prize winner, and he wrote an interesting article on accelerating creation. Because we maintain creatio ex nihilo, which means that God created the universe from naught. From nothingness. There was no primary matter. The Greeks had assumed that there was always a primary matter. And that God fashioned the primary matter. Whereas Yadus maintained creatio ex nihilo. And Arno Penzias points out that the Rambam was always criticized as being an individual that stubbornly refused to accept science because of religion. He was emotional. And he wasn't a thinker when it came to the area of science because he was bound by his religious beliefs. And that's the assumption of the world that has always maintained about the Rambam. And the truth of the matter is it's false because for the Rambam the Torah was simply another source of knowledge. It wasn't a belief. It was simply another source of knowledge because God's knowledge is manifested in the universe and God's knowledge is manifested in the Torah. It's no contradiction. And the Rambam simply maintained that from his knowledge of Torah one can deduce that there was a creation. Even though the whole of the scientific world at that time, from the time of the Greeks, until recently, always maintained that there was no such thing as a creation. Creation was a myth. But modern science, and Arno Penzias was involved in this, because he discovered the background radiation, which exists in the universe as a fallout, so to speak, of the creation. And he made that discovery, and he writes here, that on the contrary, he said, the scientists that refuse today to accept creation are the ones that are being emotional. The Torah says that the one creation is exactly right according to science, according to modern science. So you realize that in the area of religion and science, those emotions either way. But the important point that I want to mention is that Yadus maintains that a person's convictions from Torah, concerning Torah, do not have to stem from the emotions, but rather stem from the intellect, from Chok. The same part of the mind that studies the nature, the same part of the mind that analyzes the cosmos, is the same part of the mind that human beings supposed to use, essentially, in Avodas Hashem, in the worship of God. And the Rambam maintained that there was a creation, not because he was stubborn or because he was a religious motivation, but because of knowledge. Because the Torah is a book of knowledge, and the Rambam knew this very well. And the Rambam's conclusion was simply based on the fact, against all science, was based on the fact that he studied the Torah. You see that this is exactly what the Torah maintains. And he held very, very steadfastly concerning that concept. And modern science is sitting up in the age of knowing in the past 1930s it was. So, about 60 years ago, around 60 years ago when it was demonstrated that the universe did have a creation. So I didn't have a chance to really make too many copies of this article, but I made 3 copies and I felt a constraint more on the Torah Messina once. So the Torah Messina,
I have 15 copies. All right. If anybody wants any more copies, I can make this for next week. So, I didn't realize how many there. What Tom Lee writes was, interesting enough, that I had written a small article on Talmudic Judaism. And then I tried to explain what the approach of Talmud was. Actually, I wanted to give that lecture before this one, but it turned out that it was announced that this is going to be turned. You see, that's why I was forced into the situation. But there's a woman that is not religious, that happened to read the article. She told one of the students of the yeshiva, Dr. Bernstein, Michael Bernstein, that she was interested in the article, but she said that the rabbis at the time were very brilliant men and rational, great intellects, great minds, but how could they accept religion? That was a question. So I felt that I have to answer that question. So I put together a few pages on the idea of Torah Messina. What I'd like to do is, before we start with Torah Messina, I'd like to just mention some premises, and I have it in the introduction. Okay. So Yahadus is a very unique religion, and a lot of premises in Yahadus really are premises that are universal in nature. They're universal in nature, and they even, unbeknown to most people, they even affect science. Certain positions, certain arguments in science that exist to this day, the Torah has very specific positions about. Very specific positions about. And every yesod in Yahadus is universal. It's wrong, for instance, in history that we learn that the first ones that had a scientific attitude towards the world, towards the universe, was the Greeks. That's not true. The first one to have a scientific attitude towards the universe was Avramovich. He was the first one. He was the one that taught the world that the religion that they're practicing, which is nothing more than projections of their own primitive emotions, is absolute nonsense. There's no basis for it. And as the Rambam describes, he wrote books, pamphlets on it, and he had these distributed. And because of this, his life became endangered, and he had to flee the country. The first ones to say that the universe is not a place of primitive mystery, but rather the universe is simply a place that manifests the endless chachma of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. First ones to say that was Yahadus. Because until the Greeks, the rest of the world maintained, when they looked up at the heavens, they were filled with a certain primitive kind of mysteriousness. And they projected onto the heavens all kinds of powers. As you know, I mean, even today, the people will read the horoscope in the papers, and this exists today, and it existed for thousands of years, and nothing else existed at that time. When Yahadus came upon the scene, the rest of the world was completely steeped. When Yahadus came upon the scene, the rest of the world was completely steeped in primitive mysticism. And Moshe Rabbeinu says so in the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu says in Devarim, he says, "Can Kisos a Nechma Shemayna? You lift your eyes to the heavens. Reisos a Shemesh, a Reich, a Kochav, and Kol Tzwa Shemayim. V'nidachta v'shtachav Yisolam v'avadatam." He says, "You'll bow down to the heavenly bodies and you'll worship the heavenly bodies, project powers onto them." And then Moshe Rabbeinu says, "Asher cholak ad Hashem lekecha osom v'chol ha'amin tachas kol Hashemayim." Plus, it's a strange passage. God gave them to all the nations. What does it mean, all the nations? What does that have to do with it? The answer is because people always project onto the heavens, that the heavens hold, forecast their own personal, private future. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, "Deny this." He said, "It's not true. This was given by God to all the nations. All the nations should be able to partake of the benefits of the universe. But there is no, on the contrary, there are no mystical powers in the heavens. And the only force and the only power that exists is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the heavens are nothing more than Hashemayim, a sovereign Kol Kel. And if you study the heavens, you'll understand Chachmas Hashem. And the Gemara criticizes a person who doesn't study astronomy. The Gemara criticizes him. Says that God says about such a person, Asher Kol Yodai Lo Ro Maisa Yodai Lo Dibur. Such a person, God says about him that he is not interested in seeing my wisdom. That's what God says about such an individual. So the ones that were the first ones that established the scientific framework is really Yadis. Not the Greeks, but Yadis. The first ones, at a time when there was no other nation that had any concept like that. But on the contrary, they're all speaking in nonsense. Another mention. But there's a fact, start with that. So the, unfortunately, of course, Yadis is not well understood, and we're not very quick to gain credit for things that we have, even though we are well understood. Historical. So the principles of Yadis are very far-reaching. Very far-reaching. They're fundamental principles. And they, I'll give you an example. For instance, I have a friend of mine who's a theoretical physicist. His name is Dr. Carl Rosenzweig. He's a theoretical physicist, and he's in Syracuse University. And I was speaking to him about something that came up from a concept of Yadis that has to do with the world of science. I mentioned to him that that you could see that Yadis maintains that there's such a thing as human intuition. Human intuition. Because the halacha is when there's a machlokas in the Gemara, so every person, even today, a person has a right to follow. If he's a scholar, he has a right to follow his own view. Now, what right does he have to do that? When scholars debate in the Talmud, they induce all kinds of evidence. If one can be refuted, he withdraws willingly, happily, that he discovered a new idea. The Gemara was never upset with him, there was no argument. They were happy because they gained new knowledge. So, if an argument exists, it means no one could prove either way, which way was correct. So then the halacha is each person has to follow his own mind. So this implies the concept, the idea, that a person, there is such a thing as intellectual intuition. Which means that a person can, through his intellect, intuit certain ideas, even though he can't prove them. And he could be wrong, but he could very well be right. And in Halacha states the fact that Moshe Feinstein has a right to follow his own intuition, even though he says many things which can't be proven, demonstrated clearly from the Talmud. He will show the framework upon which he bases it, but then he'll make his own move, and he'll say, I believe this is what it is. And he may even say that I can't prove this, but this is the way I understand the area. I understand this to be this way. He has a right to follow his own way. Rabbi Soloveitchik can come to another conclusion. So, from this fact, from this halachic concept, from the mere concept that there is a halachic debate and that a person has a right to his own intuition, we can deduce the fact that we do maintain that there is such a phenomenon. Now, in science, you have different philosophies. There are philosophies in science which are purely empiricistic, which means that they believe that any ideas that we have are really valueless, and the only thing that we really give credibility to are scientific data. And you might use your guess or your hunches to discover certain things, but that's a separate process. But the only thing that has reality are the physical entities. But the ideas don't have any true reality. They're just means through which you can grapple and arrive at certain conclusions. When your conclusions are demonstrated, then we know it's true. But the conclusions, the ideas behind the conclusions don't partake of some abstract reality that exists in the universe. So, how we can arrive at such conclusions is a separate, whole separate discussion, a whole separate area of philosophy of science. But that's not the point. The point is that there are opinions in science which maintain that the only thing that we have is really the experimental proofs. And beyond that, there's no real true world out there of ideas that a person can intuit from. See? Other scientists disagree. I mean, Albert Einstein, Dirac, they were a group of scientists that maintained that a person, if he's properly tuned, will be able to intuit certain things about the universe. There is such a thing as a God-given intuition. And I discussed this with my friend from Syracuse, And he maintained that he told me that it's interesting. He says, but the bulk of the scientists today are opposed to that view. He said, it's true. Albert Einstein did hold that way, and Dirac did hold that way, and a few others held that way. But he says the bulk of scientists, of scientific theory today, is not going in that direction. But Yonatus, without a doubt, fully maintains that that is so. So there are certain there are certain far-reaching conclusions that go beyond Talmud that can be deduced from the Talmud, from principles of the Talmud. It's an interesting thing. Another demonstration of that would be the fact that we have the fact that we maintain that empiricism is not true, can be deduced from a mitzvah that we have. We have a mitzvah of Torah Lishma. What does Torah Lishma mean? Torah Lishma means learning Torah for no other reason than the learning itself. Now this means not learning Torah to paskin hashayla. The paskin hashayla is not really Lishma. It means you have a purpose, you have a motivation. But it means learning Torah without any reason whatsoever, just to appreciate the beauty of the thought, of the ideas of the Torah. That's the mitzvah of Torah Lishma. For instance, I mean, in our yeshiva right now, we're learning Zvachim. And Zvachim has no practicality for that. And no one is asking any shadows of Zvachim, because we have no Beis HaMikdash, unfortunately, at this time. But the mitzvah of learning Zvachim exists just as much as the mitzvah of learning Shabbos, which is the most important mitzvah of Torah, as you know. So you see that in Torah we have an idea, not simply for practical purposes to learn Torah, not just to know how to do a mitzvah, not even for that practical purpose, but just to know the ideas. This means to say that when you're involved in the world of Kachem, even though there's no Beis HaMikdash today, you're involved in a world of God's thought, and this is what man is supposed to do. So Yadis posits the existence of ideas, the existence of thought in the universe. And not just in relation to Torah, but if it's God's thoughts in relation to Torah, there are God's thoughts in relation to the universe as well. So from a mitzvah, you can draw a far-reaching conclusion, which even goes over the barriers of Torah, past the barriers of Torah, to the world of science. And Yadis' position would be anti-empiricism, and the position of Yadis would be definitely in favor of theoretics, that there's a theoretical world, and very much like, I happen to read a lot of what Albert Einstein wrote on his Thoughts of Science, very much in line, if not identical, with what he says concerning science. But his position happens to be identical with the position of Torah. So I just want to show you that from Torah itself, there are certain deductions that can be made that are carried over beyond the realm of Halakha, from Halakha itself. The Rav's book, The Halakh Mind, which is very difficult to comprehend, I mean, unless you're a professional philosopher. But the end of the book, the Rav mentions, the last phrase, he says that one day from the world of Talmud, the whole world of science will open up, from concepts found in Talmud. And there is no doubt that that's true, because the Talmud is the ideas of God, and the ideas of God are far-reaching, very far-reaching. And the Rav mentioned one time that the profundity of Torah, the depth of Torah, the profundity of Torah, the method of analysis of Torah is even by far advanced over modern scientific method. And the Rav wasn't just saying that because of the fact that he's a Talmudist, but he said it because he knows the world of science, and he knows that it's so. He studied both areas. And there is no doubt, I mean, there's no doubt about it, that for instance, Rav mentioned that Chaim Brisker, as his grandfather, he said intellectually he stood head and shoulders over Immanuel Kant, who was considered one of the greatest minds that the Western civilization has produced. The depth of Yadis, in terms of theoretical abstraction and thought, is not known to the world, even to this day. An amazing phenomenon, but it's not known. We are totally mistaken and misunderstood as being something that we are not. And we are confused with the other religions, when really, in reality, we have nothing in common with them. With that premise, I'd like to start off the concept of Torah Messina. Before I get to the Torah Messina itself, I'd like to mention that the idea of Torah Messina, in a similar way, the demonstration or the proof of Torah Sinai is based on certain premises that, again, are very far reaching, beyond the mere subject matter of Torah Sinai.
Yeah, if I could just stop you on that point. A lot of times people ask me, who are less religious than I, and I'm around the scientific community constantly, and one of the things that I'm attacked with, which I think is an interesting point to bring up, is the Torah lists that the world is a number of thousand years old. And my friends will say, well, how do you explain the carbon dating with the radioactive half-life that dates back millions and millions of years? They see the difference between that and the prediction of the Torah, and the only answer that I had is that a day may have been different in our counting than in yours. But do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I do. But the only thing is, I would rather take it as a separate subject. Because it's a bit involved, and also it involves the concept of evolution. And where do we hold with regard to evolution, which is a subject that's that has to be taken up in conjunction with that. I think it's an important one. And I would like to, now that it's one of the topics I was thinking of doing, I would like to, I noticed a lot of books written about evolution by Rabbonim, and a lot of books written about religion by evolutionists. And if I would give a talk on it, I would limit myself to the rabbinical side, not to the evolution side. But I would like to show what Yadus maintains is possible to accept according to halacha, and what is not possible to accept. I can't go into that area, but I would be able to delineate from the boundaries from Yadus, so that I'd leave that area open and to certain and close to other possibilities. We have to do another one. Maybe next week. We have one more together. So, getting back to this point, the premise of Torah Misinai is very important. Not just because of the proof of Torah Misinai. Why do we believe Torah Misinai? But what the idea of Torah Misinai demonstrates, what it shows us, what it means to us. It's interesting that the pasuk when it talks about Torah Misinai, the pasuk says Kol Gadol V'Lo Yosef. Moshe Rabbeinu says it's a Kol Gadol, a great voice, V'Lo Yosef. It will never happen again. Which means to say that Maimon Har Sinai was a one-time event, which was planned by the Creator, and it was to happen once and never again. Okay. Now, this is important. Sounds like, okay, it doesn't make any difference to us if it would happen again. Perhaps we want it to happen again. But why is this important? I mean, this is not just a coincidental matter. There's a purpose and an idea behind this. And I believe it is as follows. It has to do with the whole way of looking at the world, the whole world view of Torah. And that is that in other religions, man looks for God to the mystical actions. That's the nature of religion in general. Look to God through mystical actions. I don't know if you remember recently, they claimed they had this statue that had tears, this type of thing is what the world is impressed by, and that's where they look to find God through these type of things. We don't have anything like that. Nothing like that. As a matter of fact, we criticize. The Rambam, for instance, criticizes people that search for God, you see, through the mystical. And mystical is a dead word. This mystical has two senses. In one sense, we believe in something mystical, but not in the I would say, Rambam is against someone who looks to God through the miraculous. That would be a better term. The Rambam mentions as follows. He says that it's Rambam the Morning Book. By the way, if you have a Morning Book with a Friedlander translation, there's a mistake in this translation. I correct it. It's as follows. He says, it's on page one, bottom of page one. Say to a person. Say to a person who believes himself to be of the wise men of Israel that the Almighty sends his angel to enter the womb of a woman and to form there the fetus. He will be satisfied with the account. He will believe it and even find in it a description of the greatness of God's might and wisdom. Although he believes that the angel consists of burning fire and is as big as a third part of the universe, yet he considers it possible as a divine miracle. But tell him that God gave the seed a formative power which produces and shapes the limbs, and he will turn away because he cannot comprehend the true greatness and power of bringing to existence forces active in a thing that cannot be perceived by the senses. Okay? So the Rambam here is, now the correction that I made is like this. The Rambam started in the beginning of the statement is, say to a person who believes himself to be of the wise men of Israel. The way Friedlander had the translation was, say to a person who is considered to be of the wise men of Israel. There's a big difference. Because if you say it's considered to be, it means that the nation, we support this view. And then we mean the Rambam is criticizing all of Klal Yisrael. It's not so. So say to a person who believes himself to be of the wise men of Israel, not the one that actually believed to be of the wise men of Israel by all Klal Yisrael. It's an important correction. But at any rate, it's obvious over here what the Rambam is criticizing. The Rambam is criticizing a person who looks for God in the miraculous. So to him, the phenomenon of childbirth is a phenomenon of angels and all kinds of mysterious miracles that are going on, and he considers this the greatness of God. But if you show him God's wisdom, and he really studies embryology, and he sees the Chokhmas Hashem, the infinite wisdom of the Creator, and how things are formed, how things are created, anyone that has ever even just slightly studied the area is amazed. So if you show him that, he turns away. See? This is the Rambam's criticism. Now, this is a very important criticism, because what it means to say is, it's telling the person where he searches for God. Now, according to the Rambam, if a person searches for God through the miraculous, he's on the wrong trail. I mean, that's not what this is all about. And this explains really what Kol Gadol V'lo Yasof means. Because what does Kol Gadol V'lo Yasof mean? That God will never perform the event of Maamar HaSinai again? It means very simply, it means God doesn't like to break the laws of nature. He doesn't wish to break the laws of nature, and he doesn't wish us to know him through any breach in the laws of nature. On the contrary, what does the Rambam say? And I believe I mentioned this once before. And the Rambam says, what is the definition of the love of God? The love of God is he who contemplates the universe and who sees God's infinite wisdom, his endless chokhmah, and the moment he perceives this, he's awed by the Creator. So Yadus tries to teach a person to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu through what? Through the Chokhmas Hashem. Now a miracle is a breach, a break in the Chokhmah, the system of Chokhmah, because that's what a miracle is. It's a suspension of the natural law. So if Yadus wanted man to know God through miracles, then we have an endless series of miraculous events and suspensions of the laws of nature. And some people wonder why we don't have that. Like they say, well, why don't we have those miracles today? The reason why we don't have those miracles today is because that's exactly the opposite of what the Torah is trying to do. The Torah is trying to teach a person to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the infinite Chokhmah and the order of the system, the order of the cosmos, the Chokhmas HaTorah. That's where Torah reaches a person. Not through the miraculous. That's why the Rambam criticizes those individuals who search for God through miracles. He says, and you tell this person how really, give them an understanding of how things actually work scientifically, he turns away, he's not interested. He has no interest in talking about this anymore. Yes?
In the war, many people are speaking of miracles.
Right.
Of missiles that did not explode, of missiles that landed in space between those buildings. Would you say that these were possibly extensions of the
natural law? I would say this. I would say the following about that. We have halachas concerning that. You see, what I'm talking about is the way to perceive a correct bargain. And if a person is looking for those missiles, that this is going to give them a muna and a Kaddish Baruch Hu, that muna is not the proper muna. If a person is looking to support his muna, and those kind of events, he's going against the Torah. Because the Torah maintained, as you know very well, that the Rama, it's halacha, Hashim Shem Avorcha Malako, just like we make a bracha on that which is good which occurs to us, so too, we have to make a bracha on unfortunate, or if one wants to learn something bad happens. And the Rambam says we have to do it with the same happiness, the same joy that you make a bracha on the event which you consider fortuitous. So you see that if we're going to base, if a person's emunah is going to be based on a missile not exploding, then the next missile that explodes, he's going to have to lose his emunah if he's going to be consistent. And this is not the others. I mean, unfortunately, Goyim always pointed. Osim me'ava, they serve God out of love, and smeichim me'isim. No matter how bad and how difficult life is, they accept it with contentment. So their emunah, anyone's emunah that's based on the fact that God is doing actions that are favorable for him, his emunah will be very short-lived. Very short-lived. As a matter of fact, even if everything, l'af t'ashem v'tah v'chol avav v'chol nash v'chol ma'odecha v'chol nida u'mida shem v'chol. Whatever God measures out to a person, and that's what he must accept. So you see that the emunah can't be based on the fact that some miraculous event occurred to me or to Klal Yisrael. It can't be based on that. Because then when untold events occur, that means there's no emunah. From a practical standpoint, and more than a practical standpoint, from a standpoint of understanding, Yadis does not cater to that. We believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu not because he's good to us. We believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu because we know HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We know HaKadosh Baruch Hu exists. And there's no way for a person to deny it. Because there's no way to deny his existence, because we must accept his existence, because we know he exists, that's why we believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Not because of what he does for us. That's an ava, shekhriya b'dov. That's what Gemara says. An ava which is dependent upon something that's not ava sashan. So, it's okay, there is a halacha of a nes. Halacha of a nes is if a nes occurs, so then the halacha is, you're chayyad, you mishabeach HaKadosh Baruch Hu, shalach hodoh. There's a certain halacha with regard to that. Go down the hook of drugs. But there's nowhere does it mention that because of a nes, a person's emunah should be increased. And I'll show you, by the time we finish this paper, that if a person's emunah is increased by a nes, then he doesn't have the proper emunah. Because his emunah is supposed to be so steadfast that the nes means nothing. And I'll show you even the case, we'll soon get to a parsha in the Torah, when nisim can occur against what we believe, and it does not affect us. One iota. That's a parsha in the Torah, yes?
Our role is in the Nithra of them, the great people. After all the nisim and the Kriyas Yamsuf and so on, the name of Rima or whatever it was, the case tomorrow, yeah. They had started to complain.
Exactly. The rest of that. That's all that's meant. Because Nisim, the effects of Nisim are very short-lived. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu instituted Talmud Torah. 3 days in the Bar, he instituted Talmud Torah. Because Talmud Torah is something which is left. It's knowledge. Nisim are not something that influences us. And the basis of Yadis is there's only one occurrence upon which we base our emunah. One occurrence alone. And that is Maimer Asim. That's my medicine. One event that happened once, Kol Gadol V'lo Yosef, will never happen again. God introduced this event just in order to establish Klal Yisrael, and that was it. Okay. Now, All right. So it comes out like this. That the basis of our emunah is an event which is a supernatural event by any account, without any doubt. And that's the Maimar HaSinai, the supernatural event. And this event was to occur once and for all, and that's it. So that the occurrence established Yadus, but henceforth, the turning of the individual towards God is not through miracles, but through Chochmat HaTorah. Now let's get into the event of Torah Mishinai. The first thing I wanted to mention with regard to the event of Torah Mishinai is that the event, as you know, the Torah describes, is consisted of certain visual and audible phenomena, as you know. The elements of fire, clouds, pillars of smoke, the sound of the shofar, were all present. And at the same time, God produced an audible voice, which was of immense proportion, that he used to speak to Moses and then to the people. Okay? Now, the Maimar HaShina, the demonstration, the essence of the demonstration was the voice that was produced by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. No one, of course, should make the mistake of thinking it's the voice of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, HaKadosh Jean. That would be against all that rule. God doesn't have any voice. It was a voice that was produced by God. The voice was one that was heard by the entire people, and it conveyed ideas that they heard. Ideas that they heard, that they all heard, and all understood. Okay. Now, the fact that this was, that Maimar HaShina was done in order to demonstrate to the people not only the existence of God, but really, what was Maimar HaShina for? Not simply for the existence of God, for something more than that. Something even more, for more than that. It was for the veracity of Torah. To show that the Torah is true. And what does it mean that the Torah is true? It means that we have implicit faith in Moshe Rabbeinu. Because every word of the Torah that we have today came from Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's the reason why the voice that God produced spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu, and the people heard. And Rambam explains, Moshe, he said, he heard the voice speaking to Moshe Rabbeinu, and then they heard the voice produce the Aseret HaDibros. Whether we heard the first two or the ten, I'm not going to get it. But two Dibros, everybody agrees. The whole part is relevant. Okay? So the Dibros were heard by Kol Yisrael. And the fact that this was done in order that there was a purpose behind that is mentioned opening the Torah. The Torah says in Shemos 19, I will come to you in a thick cloud so that all the people will hear when I speak to you. They will also then believe in you forever. Well, I made a correction here also. This was from the Kaplan of Chumash. For some reason, the word also was omitted from the second sentence, which it shouldn't be. But the Pasuk says, "V'gam b'choy yamim l'olam," and also in you will they believe forever. But he had it, they will then believe in you forever, which is really not correct. Because we don't believe in Moshe Rabbeinu, we believe in God. But they will also believe in you forever means that they'll believe in God, and that Moshe is the one that is the conveyor of the ideas of God. The different sense that we believe in Moshe and we believe in God. We believe in God, but we also believe in Moshe in the sense that he was the appointed messenger of God, and God would not appoint a messenger that's going to convey false ideas, that would convey non-truths. So that's how we know that everything that Moshe Rabbeinu gave to us was the word of God. Okay? And the Pasuk says openly that was the purpose of Maimar HaShina. So God said in advance that that's the purpose. And by the way, learning the proof of Maimar HaShina, according to Ramban, is a mitzvah min HaTorah. A mitzvah min HaTorah to understand the proof of Maimar HaShina. And not only that, but if you don't understand the proof of Maimar HaShina, a person who doesn't understand the demonstration of Maimar HaShina, he lacks in terms of his emunah, in terms of his emunah. You see, there's a thing that has to be said here with regard to the concept of emunah in Yadis as well. That we differ very much from a religionist, a strict religionist, in our idea of emunah. Because, you see, the strict religionist does not require any proofs. A religious person doesn't require any proofs. He feels his beliefs. He senses his beliefs. He just feels it's right. And that's why you have the various religions, and each individual religion, the ones who are the followers of the religions, they base their religion upon their feelings. They feel that this is true, and that's why they believe it. The Yadis does not hold that. Yadis maintained that was the case. As a matter of fact, it's unfortunate, but even as I said before, there's a lot of misunderstandings about the Yadis. I saw somebody he said that, is there room for doubt in Yadis? So he says, on the contrary, that's the whole religion is. If you didn't have any doubts, what would your problem be? You would do everything, do all the mitzvahs. You have to have doubt. But this can't be so, obviously, because we come out of the first generation, that's all Maimar HaShina. They wouldn't have any religion. They wouldn't have any doubts. Okay? We don't find that Kol Yisrael doubted Maimar HaShina. And when they complained, they always complained about Moshe Rabbeinu. You know, they didn't complain about God. They complained about Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu said, you're making a mistake. You keep complaining about me. You're really complaining about God. But they directed their complaints against Moshe. You're not a good leader. Why did you take us here? Who told you? Who gave you this idea? So the concept of Yadus, the fact that Yadus, that God says to Moshe Rabbeinu that I'm going to demonstrate through Maamar Har Sinai the truth of this religion of Yadus, shows you that the Torah never demands of a person that he believes something without any evidence. As a matter of fact, in Devarim, when Moshe Rabbeinu speaks in his last days before he was Nifta, when he spoke to Klal Yisrael, he always said, "Ata Horeisa Ladas, you were shown, it was demonstrated to you. Einecha Moroz, you have seen with your own eyes." Constantly. You'll never find in another, in the prophets. You'll never find the prophet criticizing Klal Yisrael, saying because they're not religious enough. No, you don't find anything. On the contrary, the prophet always says, God says, I'm not interested in your kabbonis and your tefillos. Better do justice, honesty, mishpat. So the prophet criticizes the false notions of religiosity. And the prophet always criticizes Klal Yisrael for being an am sochal, foolish, not irreligious, foolish. Because you left Makar Mayim Chayim, you leave God, and you know your history, God took you out of Mitzrayim, gave you the Torah, and you refuse to abide by that system, which your mind recognizes as true, and you go after folly, after nonsense. So the prophet always criticizes the Jews, not because they're not religious emotionally, because they're foolish. That's what the prophet says. Look through the museum, you'll see. You know, one place where it says they're not religious. It says he goes to Amsaf. Foolhardy, which means that they don't follow Chacham. And the prophet always, the Chacham is always the whole I'm the novel of a low Chacham. That's the criticism. Chachma is always the highest praise of the Chacham. Not only in Mishlein, Kehelis, and all the Nevi'im straight through. Chachma is the highest level. In contradistinction to this, I mean, as Bertrand Russell says, and in Lahavdil, but I think it's worth mentioning, that there's not one word in the New Testament that praises the idea of knowledge. Chacham. Okay. The Yadus is diametrically opposed to the other religious attitudes. The difference, I try to crystallize as best I could the difference between a religionist belief and between a belief of a Torah Jew. And I don't mean to be shocking about it, but listen to it slowly, I think you might understand what I'm trying to get at. And that is that a religionist, I put it this way, a religionist believes first in God and then in reality. And it's in his mind and his senses. And in Judaism, it's exactly the opposite. That we believe in our mind and our senses, our sense perceptions and our mind, that we accept, and we use them as tools of appreciating and recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But our belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not simply just a feeling. Not just a feeling. The Torah does not trust feeling. The Torah doesn't trust feeling. As a matter of fact, there's an amazing pasuk in the Tzavim in the Devarim. The pasuk describes in the Tzavim where Moshe Rabbeinu forced in the Klal Yisrael, not physically, but he coerced them through his influence to accept the Torah, but all over the world, that serious catastrophes will occur to them if they don't accept the Torah. And he says that lest there be among you an individual who turn away from the Torah and follow the gods of other nations, and he says, and this individual will say, Shalom Yehudi, I'll be at peace. Why? Ki b'shrirus li b'elech. Because I'm going to follow the ways of my heart. It's a strange thing. Why is the Torah, is the only case in the Torah where the Torah gives the reasoning behind the sin? The Torah, a lot of the verse, in the kosher, it doesn't even go for the reason. Over here, the Torah says that the sinner will say, they'll say to himself, that b'shrirus li b'elech, I'm going to follow the ways of my heart, my desire, and shalom yehudi. Well, you show me, of course, every person that sins says, show me, otherwise, what is it? What is the timing? The timing is like this. The Torah is saying is that there is a tremendous attraction to religious beliefs that stem from an inner feeling. And these inner feelings are very powerful, and they give a person a certain sense of security. That's why people believe in these religions. The reason why people believe in their religion is because the religion is something which gives them a sense of security, a very strong sense of security. That's what Torah says. Shalom Yehud, the person who serves the gods of other nations, will say to himself, Shalom, he'll feel that security, he'll feel that draw, that security. Why? Keep Ashurus Libelech. I'm simply, I'll follow the ways of my heart. I mean, it's not his chachma, but he follows the ways of his emotions. And he feels that sense of security, and the Torah says he should know that Lo Yova Hashem Slach, well, God will not forgive this individual, and God, in the whole description of God's anger toward this individual, and God will uproot this individual and destroy him and remove him from Klal Yisrael. What is the Torah trying to say? That is just the opposite. You think you feel security with these emotions, with these religious emotions, alien religious emotions. On the contrary, these emotions are your destruction. That's what the Torah is pointing at. So Yadus demands that a person's emuna be based on sechel, on knowledge. And that's why God gave the demonstration of Tarfon Sinai. If it would be otherwise, there wouldn't be any need for a demonstration. On the contrary, God would say, Moshe Rabbeinu, you tell the people to believe, and that'll be the test to see if they believe or not. But the Torah of God didn't do that. God was just exactly the opposite. That the whole Torah should be based on this event, and the event of Maimon Asher.
Excuse me, Rabbi.
Yes.
Tell me if you would agree or disagree with this. The implication of what you're saying is basically we accept that the Torah is given to us at Mount Sinai, and that is our proof. But an offshoot of that, there are many things that we do in the halachic laws, that are based on pure faith. For example, we don't really understand, to my knowledge, maybe somebody else does, but to my knowledge, the laws of kashrut, we know we're supposed to do them, and we know there's a reason for it, but the reason doesn't seem to be clear. So we are taking something and doing it on faith based on the proof of Har Sinai.
Right.
I mean, so not everything we do we're able to utilize our seichel.
Okay.
So I'm saying that's a kind of faith without evidence, but we know the evidence must be somewhere.
Okay. Let me explain that point. There are two points involved in your question. The first question is, do we understand the ideas of the laws of kashrus? For that we do. That my answer is we do understand the laws of kashrus. Because the laws of kashrus, there are two sets of laws that are given to us in the Torah that come under one framework. It's called Kedusha. The Rambam has it in Sefer Kedusha, which means holiness. What is holiness? Holiness consists in two things. Actually, it's one thing, but it concerns two areas. It means man's control of the appetitive desires. And this means the sexual desires, sexual instinct, as well as the appetitive. That's really why Kedusha, and Sefer Kedusha, the Rambam has Maicholos Asuros, foods we are prohibited to eat, and also Arayas, the various individuals that we are prohibited to have intercourse with. So it's all in one Sefer Kedusha. So we do understand what that means. What that means is very simple. It means that holiness for man really consists of one thing. And that is that an individual, holiness does not consist like other religions think in denying one's instincts. And for instance, Christianity denies sexuality. That's not holiness. And it doesn't consist in the other side of the coin where people are completely involved in the physical, in their physical desires. But it consists in one thing, which is the control, the supremacy of the Chochmas HaAdam over his instincts. That's what man is. And that makes man. That's man's definition. That's why the Ravid wrote a sefer on Hilchas Nida. He called it Bala HaNefesh. Why? Because what does it mean, Bala HaNefesh? Bala HaNefesh means, Bala HaNefesh, the more is it a high time. If it's Bala HaNefesh, that means it's a very high praise, Bala HaNefesh. What does it mean? It means a person who's a Baal over his Nefesh HaBani. A person who's in control. And Yadus gave us the halachas of kashrus for one reason, basically. The reason is that man should know that everything he desires to taste or to partake of, he does not have to partake of. And he's not permitted to. And he can satisfy his instincts at certain times, but at certain times he can't.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, the method that he uses to determine when he can and when he can't is what? Is the Shulchan Aruch. And what is the Shulchan Aruch? A deep system of theoretical law. So that is Kedusha. When a person sees something and he has to know, is this kosher or not? And he says, just a second, what's the ingredient? You find the ingredient? That's a question in your day, and he has to go through the halacha, he has to study the halacha, and he has to consult his mind, consult the halachic system, and he comes out with the conclusion,
it's tricked. That's condition. I can't partake in this. Or if it comes out of the conclusion, it's kosher. The Gemara says, what does that mean? It means the person has a shiloh about a piece of meat, whether it's kosher or not. So it's not so simple. He has to sit down, he has to go through the sugya, learn the sugya, take an hour, and by the time he gets finished, he finds out it's mutter. So it says, you work time, kisochel. Now you can eat it, ashrecha v'tovla. Then it's ashrecha. Ashrecha means it's good for you in this world, and tovla v'olam ha'bar. Why? Because then you've acted in the highest form that a human being can possibly function at. And that is, you used your intellect and your chachma, chachmas haTorah, and then you determine whether you're going to follow your instincts or not. So that really now this is what Kedusha consists of. That is Kedusha. So the laws of kashrus are not a mystery to us as such. Why we have laws of kashrus? It's very simple. The laws of kashrus is basically to teach a man that he must have a supremacy of the mind over his instincts. That's what it means. Sometimes he could desire. That's what Gemara says. I'll tell Mary if she would sahaz it. I want the conventional rabbanim, the few rabbanim, and they said that one. I never saw a piece of chazah. I don't know if that's a milah. You never saw a piece of chazah. Gemara says, I'll tell Mary if she would sahaz it. Gemara says, don't say I don't like chazah. Contrary, you see a piece of chazah, it smells good. It could interest you. It's on the contrary. But the only thing is, kedusha is when, in spite of the fact that your desire was aroused to partake of it, your mind tells you, halacha says I can't.
But Rabbi, my question is...
Let me finish. So my point is this. We don't understand the laws of consciousness. It's not true. We understand the laws of consciousness. Matter of fact, the Rambam says, why is it that certain animals, are prohibited to ones of mutter? The Rambam says very simple. That the Torah didn't want to make it difficult for us to live. If the Torah would have said, well, we can only eat the wild animals, it would be very difficult. The Torah gave the simonim, and the simonim are basically the domesticated animals. So that the animals that we do eat, first of all, we don't destroy the species, and we only eat the animals that are domesticated, that are raised domestically, and it's available to us, yet certain ones we can't. The chaza we can't, we exercise control. But most of the animals, the Rambam points out, are kosher. Because God didn't want to make it difficult. The Torah doesn't want to make it difficult. The Torah just wants to make a person function in a certain manner. As a matter of fact, the greatest ingenuity in Torah is, the most amazing thing for a person when he studies halacha and evolves himself in years of studying halacha, the most amazing thing he discovers is how many things are mutter in a system which has so many isur. It's an amazing thing. But the reason is, because God doesn't want to make things us. God wants us to be knowledgeable. To know when we eat something why it's mutter, to understand it. Not the Torah doesn't want, God doesn't want a person to suffer. He wants them to make a decision, that it should be a mental decision that determines his action. That is kedusha.
But I still don't understand, and maybe I'm the only one who doesn't understand it, but I don't understand why you can't mix milk with meat.
Okay.
How does that affect your soul?
Okay. The plain understanding of milk and meat is simply, see, you have like this. You have a parallelism in only two areas. You have parallelism between the appetitive and the same thing with regard to the sexual. With regard to the sexual, you have certain individuals that one may never live with, and then even those that are permissible at certain times are not permissible. For instance, hochos nidah. And the same thing is true with foods. There are certain foods which are completely out of the realm of possibility in terms of halachic permissibility. And there are other foods which, even though they're permissible under certain conditions, are usur. And that's possible halach. Because there are different, because there's two different types of control that the Torah is actually putting a person through. One is that certain things he may never have, and other things, even though he has them all the time, he still has to exercise his control in terms of right now we can't have that. It's two different emotions. Some people can't tolerate the idea they can't have something the rest of their life. I'll never taste a piece of chazer. It drives them more wild. They never have that enjoyment. The Torah says that a person has to get over that fantasy. There was a very famous individual who couldn't get over that fantasy. You know what I'm referring to? That was Adam Arush. Eight Adas Tovarolo Sochom now. So we couldn't tolerate it. Never eat from the street. And there must be something here that I missed. And that was the fantasy. That's why that was the whole fake. And that's a yada's demand that certain things the person should not, must recognize that this is his fantasy, and he should get back to reality and realize he's not going to be harmed by not never tasting those foods. You know, the Gemara says that everything that's straight, there's something in the world that tastes similar to it. That's a person, in case a person can't get over that emotion. But anyway. But with regard to the other kind of situation, is some people it doesn't bother them, but out of sight, out of mind. So they don't care till every cup. But milk is inflatious, so they're attached to it. People say that it's easier to quit smoking than it is to go on a diet. Let's say quitting smoking, you never have to smoke, but eating, you have to eat. And once you start eating, it's very hard to control it. The yadus exercises that control in that matter. Even those things that are permissible in a certain condition, you have to restrict yourself. And the same thing with the arayas. So that we understand. That's not a mystery. We understand the reason for it. But your question is a good question anyways, because there are certain hukim, the Gemara says, that even Shlomo HaMelech, he couldn't understand it. But this is not an irrational thing. To do something one does not understand is not irrational. Why? Because we do it all the time, unless the person is a physician. If your doctor gives you a prescription, I don't think you understand really how that prescription is going to affect your health. But nevertheless, you take it. Why? Because it's rational to take it. But you don't understand how it works, but it's rational to take it because you know that this is something which is of benefit to you. So with regard to the chukim, and the chukim really are not the way people think, that they just have no reason. That's not the concept of a chok. A chok has a reason. But a chok is different because a chok, for example, film is a chok. And film, the target is a reason. Zechut is a chok. But why is it a chok? It's not something that you or I would ever figure out. Because if somebody asked us how to implant Zechut is a chok in the nation for generations, generations, who would ever come up with film? So that's God's chok. God knows how to prescribe the proper activity which will affect us, not only one generation, but the best possible way throughout the generations. So that's God. That's why it's a chok. But justice is something which we would come up with also, because societies come up with justice. They realize you can't have a society when one person kills another person, one person kills another person. So that's mishpah. But chok doesn't mean that it's not understood. Chok means that you wouldn't initiate such a thing. But once it's there, the Rambam and the Ramban and the Rishonim, they all give reasons for chukim. So chukim is not something without a reason. But even if you don't know the reason, it would be irrational not to follow it because you know that God has, there is a reason there, and that God does have a reason for it. So that's why it's not irrational to follow something, just like you follow a prescription of a physician, even though you don't understand the prescription, but you know you trust him, you know that he has a reason for it. So that's not irrational. Irrational is where a person does something without any logical reason. That's a different thing. That yadus does not endorse in any shape, form, or matter. To do something for no reason at all, yadus doesn't endorse that. Yadus is against that. Things that people make up on their own nonsense, they're against that. Okay? Now, so where are we at over here? The question, I mentioned the idea that the Torah, which requires evidence, really points to a certain kind of philosophy. And that is, the philosophy is that God expects us to act based upon this evidence, and therefore the event of Ma'amar HaSinai was the event that would prove to Klal Yisrael the existence of God and the veracity of His Torah. Okay. Now, this means, of course, that the proof of Torah Sinai is considered a valid proof. Now, again, I'm not going to go into what is considered a proof and what is not considered a proof, because that's an endless process. But this much I will say about it, and that is that this is again a yesod yadus. It's yadus is epistemology. There's a lot of writing, philosophy about what is considered a proof and what is not considered a proof, and it's an endless sea, okay? And it is to the point where, for instance, I'm sure you heard of solipsism. Solipsism means a person says, the only one that exists is myself, nothing else. There's no way you can disprove it. That's anything you say. I mean, you're not existent. So, no problem. solipsism is something which might be, as a matter of fact, it's hard to believe, but there were philosophers that were debating for years as to whether it's irrefutable or not. Why, I don't know. But they did debate this. I don't think Yadis would endorse such an involvement. But the point is that if we say it's irrefutable, but you see, again, Yadis maintains that there's a certain selim holokim, a certain yashra sasechel that a man is endowed with. And there's no study of logic that can supersede that system. Because any time you study logic, what are you studying logic with? You're studying with your mind. So the end result has to be that it has to appeal to the mind. I mean, there's no way to study the mind from some... We can't go outside our minds and study our minds, because all we have is our mind. So whatever logic you abide by, the bottom line has to be that the ideas of your logic have to inherently appeal to the human mind. And if they don't inherently appeal to the human mind, I don't care what they are. They just simply they have no relation to human thought. Okay? Now, Yadis maintains that there is an underlying yashas, an underlying seichel hayashas, a straight, clear mind. And when God gave the demonstration at Sinai, what the Torah maintains is that if a person has a seichel hayashas, if a person's mind is working properly and is not interfered with by crazy kinds of emotions, that he will be able to see this clearly. It has to be so. Okay. Of course, Yadis can't guarantee that a person can doubt his senses. A person can say, look, I don't know what I saw, my eyes, I can't trust anything, I don't know. There are philosophers, it sounds silly, but there are philosophers like that. But Yadis does not endorse those kind of philosophies. Yadis accepts, basically, if you say, what is the framework that Yadis accepts? It's similar to the framework of the scientists. I say similar, but it's not exact, but it's basically similar to the framework of the scientists, which means Yadis accepts sense perception, and it also accepts intellect, mind. For instance, you'll never find anywhere from Achachonim, from Moshe Rabbeinu, from torture racks, in order to understand his theory concerning the planets, okay, the revolution of the planets. Now, they thought, of course, as soon as he recants, that things are going to change, but it's silly, and it doesn't make any difference. It's nonsense, absolute nonsense. Nowhere in our history do you find that any one of the Chachamim would ever say that a person should deny what he sees with his eyes, with his mind, or what's demonstrated or what's proven. As a matter of fact, you have the Ramban says, with regard to the rainbow, he says, he starts over the Pasuk, says that God put the Keshis in the Anan, the rainbow, and he says, the plain implication would seem is that the rainbow started from the time of Noah. He says, but the Greek scientists have shown us that that's not true, that it's a phenomenon. And he says, we can't deny what our eyes see and what we know. So you see, then the Ramban proceeds to show from the Pasuk itself that a careful analysis of the Pasuk shows on the contrary. The rainbow was always in existence. But our Chachmei HaTorah never denied any aspect of science, anything which is demonstrated scientifically, is never denied. The Gemara says that there was a machlokus between the Chachmei Yisrael, Chachmei HaTalmud, and the Greeks with regard to astronomy. And the Chachomim said that the Greeks were right. They agreed. Never, this is nonsense. It's impossible to answer such a thing, because this is all Chachmas Hashem, and the more Chachmas Hashem we see, the more we're awed by it, by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, therefore, the position of Yadis is that we accept that which is Chachma, but again, Yadis maintains that there is such a thing as a Seichel HaYashar. Okay, now the question of Maamar HaSinai itself.
Rabbi?
Yes?
We have to believe that our left hand is our right hand, our right hand.
Yes. Right. Yeah, there's a Gemara.
I know what my left hand is.
Right.
Right.
Okay, that's a good example. The Gemara says this. The Gemara says that Lo Sosser, the Pasuk says, Lo Sosser min Adovor Yashir Yigil Lucha. Next time I have to say ventilation. Lo Sosser min Adovor Yashir Yigil Lucha Yom Lu Smol. Okay? It says that a person shouldn't deviate from the words of the Torah. Shouldn't deviate from the words of the Torah to the left or to the right. Okay? Thank you very much.
Yeah, to the left.
It's not locked out there.
It's locked. You can't open it.
It's not locked. 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 It's
not locked. It's
not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked.
It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not
locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's
not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. It's not locked. The question that's being raised is that there's a Talmudic statement that says, Lo sasum and adavar, you can remind me what time clock that is. Lo sasum and adavar shegidlach vayyan and smok. That you shouldn't turn, when Bezdin HaGadol, when Sanhedrin tells you something, you shouldn't veer to the right or to the left. And the Gemara says that, what does this mean? That even if they tell you your right hand is your left hand, and your left hand is your right hand, you should accept it.
Okay.
Now here's a very crucial thing. Here's a very crucial point. Because someone upon hearing the statement would say that, what are the rabbis telling us? What are the Gemara telling you? It's telling you should deny your eyesight. Deny your own knowledge. I mean, your own whatever. I mean, your body, your senses, your mind, everything. And if the Sanhedrin tells you this is your left hand, you should accept it. If it tells you this is your right hand, you should accept it. So if you take that statement literally, that's exactly what it sounds like. But here you learn a very important lesson. That in halacha, you have to know the meaning behind the statement. You cannot take statements literally. So what it means is, halakhically what it means, it does not mean that you must believe that when they say your right hand is your left hand. It means halakhically you must do it, which means to say as follows. If they tell you that you put tefillin on this hand, okay, then you have to follow, even though the halakha, even though they say absurd halakha, completely, they'll say this is your left hand, put your tefillin on your left hand. I mean, it's maybe the most wild example possible. Which means to say, if the Sanhedrin paskins, again, you know that the Sanhedrin is dead wrong on this issue. And you know they're absolutely wrong. As wrong as your right hand and your left hand, just like a person knows his right hand, that's how sure you are that they're wrong. Your mind sees clearly they've made a serious error. And they don't listen to what you're telling them, and they insist they're right, and they paskin. Now what do you do? Allah.
They run the
truth
wrong, and they
have
to bring the
Chadis,
and not you.
Exactly. if it's Chiyah Karas. But what is Allah saying? Allah is saying, intellectually, you're not supposed to believe what they say is right. There is no halacha like that. You're not supposed to give it your mind. If you give it your mind, there's no Torah anymore. You're not supposed to give it your mind, but you're supposed to follow the halacha of what they say. Why? Because halacha is a system. There can't be 50 different halachic systems, even though you'll see them today. But there's supposed to be one halachic system. So therefore, the Torah says that the Sanhedrin is the final word. And when they give their word that this is what it is, even if you know they're wrong, you must follow what they say. In practice, it's only a law of practice. There is no law, as a matter of fact, with regard to thinking. That's why the Rambam says that when there's a philosophical debate among the scholars, there's no such thing as psak halacha. You get pasuk like one. Even if you have, we have a rule. Yochid v'rabim halacha karam. But there's no halacha if many scholars say this philosophical concept. Then one scholar says the other concept. You must follow the way of the many. What do you mean you must follow the way of the many? If I think the one is right, how can I follow the many? It's impossible. You're telling me to give up my mind? That's impossible. That's why there's no halacha when it comes to theoretics. There's only halacha in practice. So, if a person learns the Gemara and he has a machlokas from Rabbein and Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah, and he is a big Talmud Chacham, he has to be a quite big Talmud Chacham, quite great Talmud Chacham, and comes to the conclusion that Rabbein was wrong. Okay? Even though if we pass him like Rabbein, sometimes pass him like Rabbein, if we pass him like him, he has a right to say Rabbein was wrong. He has a right to think that way. But he can't go against the Pesach of Rabbein. He still must in fact follow the Pesach. That's exactly what that memory means. Okay, so nowhere in the system of halacha is there ever a demand or a request for a suspension of one's intellectual conviction. Because if you do that, you have no person anymore. If I ask a person to give up what his mind tells him is being absolutely true, I'm asking him to give himself up. I mean, there's nothing left for the individual. That's why the Torah doesn't have such a mitzvah. There's no mitzvah like that. But in halacha, that's something else. I mean, halacha, you have to have a system of practice. Must be an organized, consistent form of practice which everyone abides by. Otherwise, you have many different ways and different views, and then the halakhic system falls apart. Okay, that's the idea of that Maamar Chazal. Okay, now getting to the proof of Torah Misinai itself. So what I mentioned so far is as follows, that if anyone would say that if they had the event in the Torah Sinai was really supposed to be an event that was a proof not only for that generation but for all succeeding generations. Alright? And Moshe Rabbeinu, when he tells the people, he says, teach your children and your children's children about the day you stood before God your Lord at Horeb. It was then that God said to me, congregate the people to me, and I will let them hear my words. This will teach them to be in awe of me as long as they live on the earth, and they will also teach their children. So you see clearly from the Torah itself that Moshe Rabbeinu says that Maimon HaSinai was supposed to be a demonstration not just for one generation, but for future generations as well, for this generation as well. We still partake of the demonstration of Maimon HaSinai today, just like they did when they stood by HaSinai. Okay? And it's important for us to know and to understand this. Now, if anyone would say, of course, that if they stood at HaSinai and they wouldn't accept that, I say the Torah has nothing to say to that. As I said before, you know, the Torah doesn't accept a certain framework, you accept the mind and the senses. Now the question is, how do you get from the generation of Sinai to our generation? That's the question. Okay. Now, what we have to understand over here is the following. The question we have to understand is there ever any kind of a demonstration or proof that could be a proof not just for one generation, but could be a proof for succeeding generations? In general, let's forget about the event of Sinai, but just in general, is there any way that if a person wanted to set up a proof, an event that should be known for many generations, for all future generations, would it be possible to orchestrate such an event? Okay, that's the question. Now, in order to understand that, we have to ask ourselves how we attain knowledge. And we find that there are two methods that we attain knowledge. First method is through direct observation. That's the simplest method. You observe something, you see it, and you know that's true, and that's it. See it exists, see it so. There's a second method. The second method is through others. Secondhand knowledge. Through others. We never saw anything ourselves, but somebody tells you that this and this occurred, and you accept that it's true. So if you think the person is a reliable individual, you trust them and accept that it's true. Okay. Let's call that secondhand knowledge. So there's two ways that we can gain knowledge. One is firsthand, one is secondhand. Now, interestingly enough, practically more than 90% of our knowledge, maybe more than that, and 95%, 99%, is really secondhand knowledge. Not first-hand knowledge. Because if we only went by what we knew first-hand, we would know very little. We wouldn't know the First World War existed. Many of us wouldn't know the Second World War existed. So therefore, the limitation to first-hand knowledge would limit us completely. We'd have no knowledge of any kind of science unless we started from A, performing every experiment that was ever performed, which we'd never get to perform. Every person do that. You'd have no knowledge of science, you'd have no knowledge of history. Not only that, but you couldn't even trust the physician. Because the truth of the matter is, when a person goes for a serious operation, or wants something, needs it, so then the individual entrusts his life to the hands of the physician. I don't think that most patients really ever check the credentials of this physician and prove to themselves beyond the shadow of a doubt with first-hand knowledge that he's not an imposter. I doubt it. They don't even know their own physical condition. In terms of first-hand knowledge, they accept what the physician tells them. Okay? So, anytime you go to a dentist, you're relying on second-hand knowledge. You don't know whether this person is even the one that has his diploma on the wall, whether that is really him. You trust a certain assumption. You make some assumptions. Must be. I really wouldn't do that. I mean, so you assume that's correct. And what he's doing to your teeth, you certainly don't know. Okay? If you go by your emotions, you definitely wouldn't go along with it. So you're trusting completely, implicitly, in some kind of knowledge, second-hand knowledge. Second-hand knowledge really encompasses practically all of our life. I mean, you go to a lawyer, a doctor, anything you do outside of your small area of personal vision or senses has to be second-hand knowledge. Now, the question arises. I mean, the question is, say, it's true, so why should a person put his life on the line with such little knowledge? He doesn't know what he's doing? All right, he asked three doctors, but three doctors, maybe they got together and they didn't want to rid the world of him. I mean, how does he know what's happening? So, the question is that a rational thing? I mean, even though we all do it, but is it rational or we just go along with this? The answer is that there is a method that we use. Whether we realize it directly or indirectly, we do have some kind of modus operandi that we function with. And that is as follows. Whenever we hear information, we always think, two things go through our mind. The person who conveys the information to us, we have two questions. First question is the person capable of grasping that which he's conveying? Does he have enough knowledge? Is he capable of understanding the matter? That's number one. Two, is this person an honest person, or does he have motivation for life? These are the two things that go through our mind, constantly. So, if any information that comes to our mind, we always process it through those, we make it go through those two hurdles. If we can make it over those two hurdles, then it's okay. If we take over the person, we first start to, will this person lie to me? No, we have to know, okay, now, but one second, is he intelligent enough to know what he's talking about? That would be good. If we can answer that he is not, negative to the first question, that he's not lying to us, and positively to the second question, that he has enough knowledge, we have to accept what he said is true. Alright? So the way we go about knowing that something is true when it's told to us, and we didn't directly observe it, is by inference. We infer. We rule out any possible fabrication, motivation for fabrication, and then we see whether or not he's qualified to convey the information. If we can answer both of those questions, then we can accept or discard, depending on how we answer them, discard the information. All right? The reason why we accept that there was a First World War is because we say, well, the First World War, if there was a World War, it would be known at that time all over the world. So it wouldn't be an event that would require them of the greatest wisdom in the world to comprehend that it occurred. Okay? It would be widespread. But maybe somebody has a motivation to fool us. So we say that that would be, if one person would tell me this, possible. And they have some, either they're untrustworthy or maybe they could have some neurotic reason. Anything's possible with one individual. Okay? But if the whole world says that it's so, it would be, you'd be very hard put to say that they all had a conspiracy against you, unless a person is paranoid, he wouldn't accept such an idea. He would assume that there is no universal conspiracy, and therefore he accepts the fact is true. That's how we accept all major events in history, based upon that. Anything we do, I mean, if you pick up a book that says, written by Albert Einstein, so you'll say, how do I know he wrote the book? Based on first-hand knowledge, prove that it would be very, very difficult, not impossible to do it. But the assumption is that the publishing house would not fabricate such a thing, because you know they'd get into serious trouble, and therefore you counter their motivation for fabrication, and therefore you assume it's a publicly known fact, so therefore you have to assume that this is in fact the author. Anything, any way you turn it, basically, you put your life on the line based on this kind of information. Okay. Now, God gave us the proof of Torah Sinai based on the exact same premises. They're the premises we have to use in our lives, used all the time by any person. If he's a scientist, no matter what he is, a professional and not a professional, any individual that's a businessman, no matter what you do in your life, it has to be based on these two premises. Now, Yadus, when God gave Torah, he gave us Maimed Har Sinai based on the exact same premises. Exact same premises. The premises are as follows. The event at Sinai had to be an event that was one that everyone could perceive. Because if it's a very complex, something which is very deep, so then not everybody could partake of it. But if it's something which is easily observable, that any individual who is there could observe it, so then it's something which is a fact that is credible if an individual conveys this information to you. Okay? If an individual is going to convey some complex information to you, he's not intelligent enough, he's going to be doubtful about what he said. Maybe he doesn't grasp the ideas properly. But if it's a simple event, he told you he saw a fire in the street. Okay, you'll accept it. Now, one person, you might say, saw a fire in the street, you would accept it because maybe he has some motive to lie. But if everybody that came down the block told you they saw the fire, so you'd say, well, universal conspiracy doesn't make any sense. You outrule it. That's exactly the same method that the Torah uses for Torah from Sinai. That it was an event that was given in front of the entire nation, which means that it's something that was given in front of 3 million people, and therefore to say that 3 million people got together and they all invented the exact same kind of event, kind of phenomena, That's an absurdity. If a person would say that, then he could say that all of world history was fabricated in the exact same way, and he simply does not know a thing beyond the time that he was born. Okay? So Maimed Har Sinai has in it the two ingredients that are necessary to remove, to answer the two questions. The first thing is the events are simple events, which means the question, there's no question about whether the individuals that convey the information are capable of understanding the information. That's point one. Two, the question is fabrication. Fabrication is removed by us in our lives through one method, and that is through numbers. So that's why the Torah was not given to one individual, but was given in front of the entire nation. Now, somebody might ask, they might say, how do you know it was given in front of the entire nation? Maybe this itself is a fabrication. Maybe it's not true. Of course, if you say that, then you can deny all of history as well. You can say, how do you know that history is correct? Maybe one person wrote up all the events. You see, the answer to that is obvious. The answer is that you can't manufacture, just like why you accept something in history, certain things in history you're a little doubtful about. If it's a detail, you're not so sure about it. George Washington existed, you're sure about it. What size shoe he wore, you're not that sure about it. Because it's a detail. Maybe the person wasn't interested, somebody, one individual saw it, he wasn't careful. Who knows whether this fact is correct. But a fact that he existed, that you're not going to question. Because it was in front of millions of people, and to say that there was a universal conspiracy, we outrule universal conspiracy. The Torah was given the exact same ingredients. That's why it was given in front of the entire nation, in order to rule out this possibility. Now, if the person, what safeguards the information is the fact that it was given in front of multitudes of people. No one, for the same reason, nobody can manufacture such evidence. A person can't manufacture evidence and claim that it was in front of the entire nation. A person can't say that 100 years ago there was a bomb that exploded in New York City and the whole city was blown to bits. Can't say such a thing. Why? Because a person will say, oh really? Well, how come we don't have any record of that? So you can fabricate individual events, but you can't fabricate mass events. Mass events cannot be fabricated. Okay? Now, the same way with Torah. If somebody would have come along the line, Maimed Har Sinai had never occurred, and someone along the line, let's say the time of David, you know, approximately what, 800 BCE. So, of course, we know the nation at that time believed in Torah. So you have to say sometime between Moshe Rabbeinu and then someone would fabricate that. So somebody would say that a few hundred years ago, this event took place in front of the entire nation. Nobody would accept that. They'd say, really? Why can we never heard about something like that? So a mass event can never be fabricated. If it could, then you simply can't accept anything in history. Of course, I could say that all the events in history will simply be fabricated. The only thing that safeguards you is the fact that it's a mass event. So Torah was given, really, Maimed Har Sinai was given because it works with the same premises that we use in everyday life to function in everyday life. Now, of course, I said a person can argue and say, look, I don't accept anything. I accept history, I don't accept anything. Such an individual, again, is outside the realm of Yadis, of the Tzelem Elokim, the Seichel HaYashar. We don't function. We believe, Yadis maintains, that an individual who is intelligent will not deny all of history, and will not deny what his eyes don't see, but will accept it based upon these two questions, and how he resolves these two questions, exactly in the same manner as we're describing here. So that Maimed Har Sinai is based upon that which is a part of our everyday life in the same manner, exact same manner, without any differentiation whatsoever. Now you can see this is interesting. History really bears this out. Why? Because you see in history the religious motive of man is very strong. I mean, I don't have to show you this. In many religions, and you see that the religious motive of man is a very powerful force. But nowhere, I mean, in over 2,000 years, has any religion based itself on a revelation which was in the front of an entire nation. It just didn't happen. And the fact that they would want to do so is no question that the motivation is there, because as you see from the religious motive, very strong. And man. And Christianity, the two major religions, the Goyim is Christianity and Islam. And Christianity, the modern religions, Why are they modern religion? Because modern religion demands that man have some kind of objectification. Primitive religion doesn't need any objectification. Alright, you study primitive religions, you don't have to, because they project their own things right away. You know, primitive of others are. They don't need anything. They don't have any kind of proof. But modern religion demands some kind of objectification. Where does Christianity get its objectification from? From the others. Without a doubt, they believe in the Old Testament, they believe in Revelation, they believe in time is human, they believe in the prophets, and the same thing with Islam. The same thing with Islam. They accept the Torah. Why do they accept the Torah? Why should a religion that's invented by Goyim, why should they base it on our religion? I mean, why? You have to understand it. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, the whole thing is a contradiction to begin with. I mean, they if you look at it, it's kind of absurd. I mean, really, it's hard for me to believe how they accept it. They read the prophets and the Bible and constantly talk about Klal Yisrael. God will never forget Klal Yisrael. His love is eternal for Klal Yisrael. And they believe that that somehow or other that this isn't true. Yet they recite it all the time. I mean, it's absurd. How they do it, I don't know how they do it. All I know is that the anti-Semitism is no doubt an expression of the cover-up of this kind of a situation in their minds, you see. But it's an absurd thing. It's truly an absurd thing. So why do they do it? They do it because they need authentication, because it's a modern religion, and they don't have any, and they can't invent any. Believe me, if they would be able to invent a mass public kind of demonstration, they would gladly do it, without a doubt. But it's an impossibility. Can't be done. That's why they make recourse to Yahdus, to the event of Sinai. Sinai is the only objectification. And in thousands of years, since modern times, I mean modern history, no one has been able to fabricate a religion which is based upon a mass revelation. What are the Goyim say? Oh, they accept revelation. What is it? They say, yeah, but you're not interpreting it right. This is different than everything. Okay? So that, of course, a person can twist anything they want. I mean, even though it's completely absurd, because they're talking about a system that they have no knowledge whatsoever. I mean, they know nothing about the Torah and understanding the Torah. It's like to them, it's a simplistic kind of thing. Yes.
But a new set of Dead Sea Scrolls, what they found, which revealed things that let's say the world had never known before. Not just their revelation, but mass historical facts that claims happened. Would the world accept it as true, or just we not accept it as being authentic? Because no one ever heard of it either.
Well, you see, if you find some scrolls, the problem with that type of evidence is several problems. First of all, if you find some scrolls that tell you some fantastic things occurred, the scroll is the only evidence you have.
Right.
This person could have been not well mentally when he wrote it.
Right.
I mean, you don't know what the source is. The same thing is true if we find old tefillin, for instance. People always ask this question. What if we find a pair of tefillin from the time of the Beis Hamikdash, and we found the tefillin are different than the way we have our tefillin today? So an archaeologist would get very excited, but a Baal Halacha wouldn't get excited at all. Because who wrote those tomes? That's the first question. Was it a person who was competent? Or was it somebody who decided to make himself a pair of tomes, didn't know anything about Hilchos Tefillin, and put together these black boxes and they have no shackles of tomes? I mean, you have to know there has to be authentication. You have to authenticate something. You can't just find something, some ancient scroll. Well, what does that prove? Now, the Rav one time said, he says, that they're discovering now different things from the medieval periods, different scholars wrote. So Rav says, yeah, but the only problem is this. Just because a person in the 14th century sat in a room and thought he was a great scholar and wrote certain scrolls doesn't mean it has any value. The question is this person accepted as a Baal Halacha? Was he an individual that truly had knowledge? If he had knowledge, yes, of course. As a matter of fact, there was a case where they did discover a pair of tefillin that were not like Rabbeinu Tam, but the tefillin, you know whose tefillin it was. So that's why it was used as evidence in Halach. But it was Machlokes Rabbeinu Tam and the, art tefillin that we have today. And they discovered a pair of tefillin that was from many years before, and it was, but it was written, the tefillin were written by a person who knew Halacha, so that's considered evidence. A person is knowledgeable. But just because you find an ancient pair of tefillin doesn't mean anything.
They're Rashi. The reform might point out like Colossians, didn't have the world oral Torah. And therefore, it could have been a fabrication later on, because obviously there's a sect of Judaism that didn't have it. So how could it have been together at the time of Harsina? That's their proof. Then that's the proof.
No, the fact that you have people that, that don't have the oral tradition doesn't mean there's no oral tradition. You have reformed Jews today that don't have the oral tradition. So what does that mean? That there's no oral tradition?
That's the recent phenomenon.
So the recent phenomenon can happen, just because the phenomenon happens many years ago, it doesn't mean it's not the same thing that's happening now too. I'm telling you it's happening even now. So years ago you had the same thing. For instance, in the time of the Mikdash, in the time of the Churban HaBayis, the Yeshu basically came from the Essenes. They were Essenic cults. What were the Essenic cults? They had Tvilah, they had different things, but they were not into Halacha. They didn't have any knowledge of, as a matter of fact, they were anti Halacha. They hated, why in the New Testament did they constantly criticize the Pharisees? You should know. What is the criticism of the Pharisees? The most anti-Semitic book that there is. Why do they criticize the Pharisees? Because it's anti-Chachma. Who are the Pharisees? The Purushim. They're the ones that tell you that a person can't go according to the Pharisees, but he has to go according to Chachma Hashem. And the Essenic sect was completely opposed to that. They went according to their own religious emotions. And Yeshua was among them. And there was tremendous sin, tremendous hatred towards Klal Yisrael because of that. But the whole approach of the Purushim, right there, you see the approach, the difference. The Purushim were Chachamim. They said, we have to go according to Chachma. So what they did was, in the New Testament, you have lies about the way one of the Prussian would handle a situation. Absolute lies. You look at it, it's absolutely false. 100% falsified. And it's just instigated by hatred and viciousness. That they say that the Good Samaritan, you know the story where they depict the lady as a single person that's dying and you won't approach her, because everyone can't tell me. It's nonsense. Everybody knows that Sakonis and Flesh is Yochol Verkula. But this was fabricated in order to make the Purushim look like they're Bali Halacha and they don't care for human beings. So this was, there were various different sects, I mean, that existed. That has nothing to do with us. We can't stop individuals from deviating from the path of Torah. I mean, it doesn't mean because they lived 2,000 years ago that they have any kind of more authenticity than a Reformed Jew has today. It doesn't mean a thing. It has nothing to do with it. I mean, you had all along, you had the Tzedukim. The truth of the matter is, if you want to know the truth, the Tzedukim and the Conservative and the Reformed are exactly identical. It's all one thing. What is the question? The question is whether you accept Torah Shabbat Peh or you don't accept Torah Shabbat Peh. That's all it is. That is the question. What does Torah Shabbat Peh mean? Torah Shabbat Peh means is a theoretical, an in-depth theoretical analysis of Torah, which a person has to be a scholar to understand, and he has to master, and that is the corpus, the body of work that he makes a reference to. And that is the way he resolves every dilemma that he has in Halacha. Only through approaching that book, and only through approaching it through his mind and through Chachma. That is what the oral tradition means. That's Torah Shabbat Peh. And the Tzedukim and the Conservative and the Reformed are all of the same position. That namely, that Torah Shabbat Peh can either be denied or else it can be played with. One or the other. Either one or the other position. So basically this is an opposite. Tzedukim, what does Tzedukim say? The Tzedukim and the Shamronim, what do they maintain? They maintain that the Torah is literally, it says, Lo Sevaru Eish B'chomosh Lo Sechem Yom HaShabbos, you can't have a fire on Shabbos. So they weren't allowed to have a fire in the house on Shabbos. It says in the Torah openly, you can't have a fire in the house on Shabbos. Of course, the Halacha, the Torah Shabbat Peh, understand that to be a completely different thing. Completely different. So that is basically the argument. Somebody might ask, they might say, okay, there's one interesting point though before I get there. You see, the event after Yom Tov, says, Vayamid Barashim of Moshe Abdel, as you all know, Vayamid Barashim of Moshe Abdel. And the Rambam says, well, no, the Rambam, the Pasuk says, really, after that, the Pasuk says, that God told Moshe, I'm going to create the event at Sinai so everyone could see exactly, and they and their children will know for generations this event, that this occurred. Okay, that's the event that's on it. What was wrong with Kriyas Yom Tov? What was wrong with Kriyas